hands on.
That's all.
Okay, let's regroup with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Okay, I would like to say that the pictures that I have up there, there's pictures on the other side of those plastic covers too, so don't miss any of it. I have a little synopsis on each picture, so you can read it and see what it really is. It's a lot of history of AA and also history of my life. One time I read that, I'm Janice for the tape. I'm Janice, I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body a day at a time. Alice Miller said that it is not the trauma that we suffer in childhood which makes us emotionally ill, but the inability to express this trauma. And that was me. I did not have the ability to express all the trauma that had gone on in my life until I came into Overeaters Anonymous. I didn't know how to express myself. I could talk, but I couldn't really express the deep inner part of me. My mama used to always tell me that I was too curious. I was too curious. And I used to bother her, she told me. You're bothering me. She used to love to sew, and she was a very good seamstress, and she used to make my clothes. And so she dressed me really, really cute, you know, because she used to make my clothes out of sacks. I don't know if anybody knows what I'm talking about, but they had feed in sacks, in flowery sacks. And I can remember we used to go sack shopping. I think it was about 25 cents. You in the farming, y'all, they still have it? 25 cents a sack. And for 50 cents, I could have me a nice, really gathered skirt, you know. She used to make me a little tie, you know, a little tie to go with my white blouse and stuff. So, but anyway, when she was sewing, they had a little box by the side of the sewing machine. And I used to go sit on that little box and prop myself up on her sewing machine and just wanting her to talk to me. You know, you can't talk very much when you're sewing, I guess. I don't know. But she didn't want me bothering her. And she used to always say, Janice, go play. You bother me. You're too curious. You ask too many questions. But you know what? Today that I know that curiosity and wonder are the heart of learning. And I really know that what's inside of me is what's allowed me, with God's help, to learn this program. And to learn how to transmit this information, to be this channel, how wonderful that this recovery is, and to have the facts about the disease. If I don't remember these facts about this disease, I'm not going to see good reason why I have to do this. And to have to know something is to have all the facts involved. And this book of Alcoholics Anonymous gives us the facts. It gives us the facts of the illness, and it gives us the facts of the recovery. Grandiosity is about the a false sense of super responsibility and denied uniqueness. That was me. A false sense of super responsibility. I was responsible for my mom. I didn't want her to be upset. I wouldn't talk about things that I thought would upset her. And one of the things that upset her the most was me to asking her questions about my daddy. She did not want to talk about him. She did not want to talk about, it was hard for her to talk about the deaths of her babies. She used to always say that, I've had a terrible life. She used to say that, I've had a terrible life. And she did. But I didn't like to hear that. I wanted her to be happy. You know, I wanted her to talk about happy things. Another thing that I've learned is that I gave up my own reality to stop my husband from being angry. Because, you know, when you're newlywed and everything, you're trying to learn to get along with each other. And I didn't know how to keep my mouth shut. And, you know, he would make him mad. And I thought I had a right to say what I wanted to say. But what I learned in OA is that you got to kind of say it in a different way and get your point across. But anyway, the first few months of our marriage was kind of he got kind of volatile, you know. And I got scared of that because that wasn't like him. That wasn't like him. And so I learned how to not do that. And as a result, I didn't express myself in the way that I should. But gradually, you know, we got better about it, and we lived in this little 36-foot trailer. I mean, we didn't have much room to run away from each other. And we lived in this trailer park, and, you know, the neighbors could probably hear you hollering and screaming at each other. I wasn't used to that because I wasn't ever around fussing and all of that, you know. But he got a lot better, and I did too. But I know I fear anger. I feared anger, and I was really manipulated by anger also. So I know that... we had 3 children in 5 years. I was raised Catholic, and I was always taught that birth control was a sin. And so I really suffered a lot from that, because if I wouldn't have used birth control, I don't know how many kids we would have had. I mean, you know, they were just coming quicker and faster and bigger and all of that. My first child was 8.5 pounds. My daughter was 9. My last son was 9 pounds, 12 ounces. 21 inches long. He was born in 20 minutes after, you know, I got to the hospital. My husband got scared to death. He said, "That's it. They come in bigger and come in faster. I don't want any more. I'm going to have to deliver the next one, and I'm not really ready to do that." So what? Then we had to keep practicing birth control, you know. And the thing of it is, that had a lot to do with my relationship with God. The teachings of the Catholic Church and my, you know, the way I was programmed about that, because every time I got pregnant, oh boy, now I can go to communion. I can go to confession. I can go to communion. And I can remember right after my babies was born and everything, you know, they told me I had to wait 6 weeks before I could have sex again. And I'd go to a communion every chance I could until the 6 weeks was up. And then I just, you know, sinning again, you know. And so, I mean, that's how I was programmed, okay? And so I had a lot of guilt and a lot of shame around all of that. And so Jimmy was a Baptist. He was raised First Baptist, and he was raised in a real Christian home. He really was. You know, they went to church and they studied the Bible, and they knew all of that. And anyway, when Jimmy first asked me to go steady after 3 weeks of dating, this is me, I was 14. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, if we get married, we're raising the kids Catholic. Establish that right away, you know, because that's the way I was programmed. And so... I said, "We're getting married Catholic, and we're raising the kids Catholic." Okay, you know, okay. And so when we had set the wedding date and all, you know, Jimmy had to go to instructions, Catholic instructions and stuff like that. He did all of that. And he never went back on any of his promises. He really didn't. He promised my mom I would graduate. He promised me that we would get married Catholic and that we would raise the kids Catholic. And he never went back on any of his promises. When we were married 17 years, Jimmy joined the Catholic Church. And so he now we worship and pray together, and it's a beautiful thing. And Jimmy and I are both Eucharistic ministers in the Catholic Church, and you know, that's a beautiful thing. And that's one of the happiest hours of my week, is when we're in church together and he's got his arm around me, and we just worshiping together and everything. And I just adore that. I love that. I never, you know, dreamed that that I would have that, and I do. When Jimmy decided to become a Catholic, I had gone to visit my mom, and when I came back, there was a priest that was in our diocese at that time, and he and Jimmy, he was from Ireland, and so he and Jimmy became real good friends. And he used to call Jimmy the Black Irishman, because my husband has dark hair and he's dark skin. And Jimmy never understood that, why he was called the Black Irishman. And he said, he asked father that, and O'Brien was his name, and he said, well, you know, in Ireland, he said, they have the red hair, the freckles and all, and then they have the dark hair with the dark skin in Ireland, even in Ireland. And so now our chiropractor calls Jimmy the Black Irishman. I mean, you know, that's what he's called. And anyway, when I got home from my mother, from seeing my mother that time, when I got in, he told me, he says, Janice, he says, I've decided to join the Catholic Church. Not unbeknownst to me, I was shocked, you know. And people kept saying, Janice, you finally got Jimmy to join the Catholic Church. I said, I didn't have anything to do with that. It's a decision that he made on his own, you know. But anyway, it's a good thing, and I'm grateful for that we could, you know, worship as a family. But 10 years before OA, I was 28 years old. I had already had 3 children. I had all my children before I was 24. I was completely obsessed with my looks, my hair. I had no identity. I was a perfectionist. I cleaned house all the time, you know. Most especially when I was taking diet pills. I mean, you know, like clean the wall, clean the woodwork with a toothbrush, you know. I can remember one time even scrubbing bricks outside because I wanted Jimmy to make me a flower bed, and I had to get this mud all over these bricks. It's insane. I isolated a lot. I wouldn't answer the door. I watched soap operas. I lived my life through the soap operas. I overslept. I would pick at my skin. Then I would try to cover it up. Then I had to go to a dermatologist to get medication to heal me. Became allergic to penicillin. Can't take penicillin today. You know. My fingernails, I was so toxic, my fingernails were all infected. They were red and had pus in them. I was so infected. I was just destroying myself. I was so toxic. Toxic with food, toxic with anger, toxic with, you know, psychological problems. Just really, really toxic. Today I know that my life is all about my quality of life. And I know that eating right isn't just about weight loss. It's about my total health. And I know that. I know that it's important to understand the effects of food on my body. And this is for me. I know that gluten in food is not good for me. And so I do not eat foods that have gluten in it. I know that there's no free lunch. I know that I get out of life what I put into it. And I know that I get out of life the kinds of food I put into my body. I know that. And the reason why I know that that gluten is so bad for me is when I start, for 10 years, I never ate bread or anything in OA. And when I saw everybody eating the wheat, you know, and the way they were eating and everything, I thought, well, maybe I can do that. But that's when I started gaining weight back. And it was that gluten in that flour and all that was causing me to lose. I remember God led me to OA. I know that. Because I had been praying desperately. And in my town, there was a whole section in the newspaper about Overeaters Anonymous, and that this new group that had come to Overeaters Anonymous. And it was on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and it was at the church, it was in the youth center, what the church that we attended at that time. And so my soap operas was over, my supper was cooked, and I was going to that meeting. And that was another day that I walked to my destiny. And abstinence came next. I picked up, abstinence was a tool at that time. And I picked up the tool of abstinence, And I started working that too. Today, plan of eating has taken the place of abstinence, and abstinence has been is our primary purpose, which I think is a great idea. I was for that. And the next thing that came was service. Service came right after abstinence, like 6 weeks, you know. And I was doing a retreat in Memphis, and this lady said, you know, service, abstinence, God, abstinence, service, that's the acronym for gas. Yep, gas. Gives us a lot of energy. And it doesn't have to be scarce. And it doesn't cost everything except your whole life. You know, you just got to give your whole life. So anyway, that's what propels my program, gas. Okay. I want to go into the big book. I want to start this tonight because there's a lot of stuff to cover in here. And this is my large print of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my original cover book. I've had it covered 3 times, but I can barely read it. But I still have notes in there that I like to go through because I haven't transferred them all in here. But people think I got this because of my eyesight, but it's not. I like it because it lays flat. I like it because it has more room for me to write in the margin. So if you want those kinds of things in a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, then purchase you one of these. Because this book, the more I had it, you see, I don't like that. I don't like that. So anyway, I would like to say that when I first came into OA, I couldn't understand how this book could help me lose weight. I couldn't understand that. And so I borrowed the book from the library. I was going to read it through and through and find out what it said. Read it like a novel. Couldn't understand. I thought it was the most stupid book I had ever picked up. Could not understand it at all. What I learned later is that it's a textbook. It's a textbook, and a textbook is something that we learn from. We learn what our problem is, we learn what the solution is, and we learn how to go about finding the solution. So that's what this book is. I would like to share that there are spiritual riches in this book. And we have to constantly ask ourselves, what does this mean to me in my life? It's about what does this book mean to me in my life? It's a textbook, and it's to be done in order. The pages outline where each step is found in the big book, in the table of contents. But I love to read the contents of the stories. I know that third alcoholic, Bill D, it says that he kept the faith. He kept the faith. And I am so grateful that Bill W. and Dr. Bob, and then this Bill Dotson is his name, kept the faith of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that when this book was first written, the first day of Alcoholics Anonymous was June the 10th of 1935, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't put in print until April of 1939. I was born in 1939. I was born in August 7th, 1939. This book was waiting for me. I wish I'd have found it sooner, but I didn't, and it's my story. And like the country western says, I'm sticking to it, you know, because that's all I have is my own story. But, you know, young people, I love to sponsor young women with young babies and young children. Because I'm sponsoring a lady right now. She's got a little 6-year-old, and my granddaughter Lily is 5. And I just working with her because I want her to get it. Yeah, she's getting it. She really is getting it. But I've worked with a lot of people in my last years. Not many of them stay. I know y'all have seen this in your area, too. I remember when I came 17 years ago and did that convention, that room was full. It was full. He kept the faith. And so faith is the substance of things hoped for, of evidence, and the evidence of things not seen. It's a believing without proof. You know, when I came in, I just had faith of what Overeaters Anonymous was telling me. There was no proof that this was going to happen for me, but it did. It did. And there's no proof it's going to happen for the next person, but it does. It does. I'm grateful for all of that. I want to read something that I think is so vital. It's in the part before they stopped in time. And the page is not numbered, but it's back of the, it's before page 281 in this book. I share this a lot because it's so vital to me. They stopped in time. You know what? I believe that I was able to stop in time. I was able to stop in time, meaning before my body went into diabetes, before my heart was damaged, before I had high blood pressure, and before I had to take medications. I believe that I stopped in time. I believe that Overeaters Anonymous was able to raise that bottom for me, that I could... I did not have to get to 100 pounds overweight, although I believe I would have gotten there. In this page, I number my pages even though they're not numbered. So there's two blank pages before that, but I put 279. I'm reading from the fourth edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says they stopped in time. Among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. And that's what I believe about my disease of compulsive overeating. I don't think I really reached the advanced stages. Advanced stages meaning the health problems. I had a lot of emotional problems, a lot of psychological problems, but I didn't have the health problems. Okay? Though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, with hospitals, asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there had been occasional serious episode. But with many, drinking had been little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost their health, business, family, or friends. And, you know, that's how I failed. I hadn't lost my health. I'd lost my dignity. I had lost my self-respect, but I had not lost my health. Why do men and women like these join AA? The 17 who now tell their experiences answer that question. They saw that they had become actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. They realized that repeated lack of drinking control when they really wanted control was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that compulsive alcoholism already had them, that complete ruin would be only a question of time. You know, that's what was wrong. That's what happened to me, was those mounting emotional disturbances. And don't think that these mounting emotional disturbances don't continue in recovery. They do. They do. But the thing of it is, look, my father committing suicide, you know, my mother-in-law dying, my mama dying, that causes a lot of emotional disturbances. My oldest son getting a divorce, my little granddaughter having to live with a divorce like I did. You know, all of these emotional disturbances just continue. But the thing of it is that we have a solution and that we can get through these emotional disturbances. Seeing this danger, they came to AA. They realized that in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly, no sane man could wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Alcoholism is as fatal as cancer. I think compulsive overeating is just as fatal. I really do. I looked up the word malignant. I don't know if you found figured that out yet, but I'm a dictionary freak. I love to read with a dictionary. I always read with a dictionary by my side. I have worn out many, many dictionaries trying to learn what this program was telling me, what this program meant to me. But these are some words that I discovered about malignant. It says that it's very evil. It's very hateful. It's very malicious. It's very harmful. It's very infectious, very dangerous, causing death. I think compulsive overeating is that way too. I think compulsive overeating is very evil. It's very hateful. It's very malicious. It's very harmful, very infectious, very dangerous, causing death. Maybe not physical death, but what about spiritual death? What about emotional death? We could be walking around half dead inside, just going through the phases of life, not really living. This program gives us a way to live, to really live. It goes on to say that, therefore, these 17 AAs and hundreds of thousands like them have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up something like this. Why? We didn't wait to hit bottom because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I feel. I feel that OA came up and hit my bottom. And it saved me. It saved me. And I'm grateful for that because it took Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to us to be able to have this program. I would like to say that I read an article that Bill Wilson wrote in 1953, and this is some of what it said. It says that AAs are always asking, where did the steps come from? Where did they come from? And he says that in the last analysis, perhaps nobody really knows where they came from. Yet some events which led up to their formation are as clear to me as though they took place yesterday. This is Bill Wilson talking. So far as people were concerned, the main channels of inspiration, you remember I said I'm a channel? That they channeled this to us. They channeled all of the spirituality to us. And it's up to us as individuals to channel this to each other. But the main channel of inspiration for the steps were three in number. The Oxford group. If any of y'all have ever read the history of AA, that the Oxford group was a group of people that were trying to help numerous kinds of problems. Dr. William D. Silkworth of Towns Hospital. Those of you familiar with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth gave that information to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the famed psychologist of William James. And you know, in the back, in the spiritual experience, he talks about, you know, some of us come into it slowly, some of it quickly, you know, but that it'll always materialize if we work for it. Dr. William James was called the father of modern psychology. But they went on, and then Abby, you know, in Bill's story, Abby came to Bill and told him that he had gotten sober through the Oxford group, and that Bill Bill got sober on December the 14th of 1934. And the third influence was that book that he read called A Variety of Spiritual Experiences. He read that book. And he started understanding more about the spirituality of the program. And Bill Wilson is the one who wrote the 12 Steps. They had to be approved or agreed upon, but he wrote 12 Steps in 30 minutes on a plain yellow legal pad. You know, so, I mean, that's the miracle. That's the miracle of the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's great stories. If y'all haven't read the history, that, you know, A Comes of Age is wonderful, and also The Language of the Heart and Pass It On, and all of these books are wonderful. But we have our own wonderful book called Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. You know, this is the history of Overeaters Anonymous. And it's how Roseanne, our co-founder, began Overeaters Anonymous. And she went to Gamblers Anonymous is where she went. And Jim was already had been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started Gamblers Anonymous. And so the story is in here of how OA started. So we have a lot of wealth of information. And, you know, the word God is in this book 325 times. In the first 164 pages, it's in here 139 times. So it's really, you know, really, really talking about God. And I love y'all theme, promises and principles. I read on an AA the internet on AA, not AA Incorporated, but people that belong to AA, that there's 147 promises in the first 164 pages. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that information also. The title page gives us a big promise, the title page of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that it's the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. That is a promise that I can be recovered from this hopeless condition of mind and body. I have a condition of my mind, and I have a condition of my body. I know that today that I need to stay in order to stay spiritually well. I must stay spiritually fit, emotionally balanced, and physically abstinent in order for me to be recovered. Also, I know that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a book of experiences. And it's for me to start having these experiences for myself. And I do. I have them. I know that this book is more than a book to transmit information. It is a book designed to transmit an experience sufficient enough to enable me to recover. I will need more than my own knowledge to stay abstinent. And in the preface of this book, it tells us that this book became the basic text of the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the last paragraph of the preface, it's Roman numerals XII. What I did in my book was I wrote the numbers because I'm not very good at Roman numerals. I'm not very good at that. But so that is Roman numerals 12. It says that at the bottom there that all changes made over the years in the Big Book, AA members' fond nickname for this volume, had the same purpose, to represent the current membership of Alcoholics Anonymous more accurately, and therefore to reach more alcoholics. If you have a drinking problem, we hope, you know, they were giving us hope way back then in the preface in 1939, that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me. And more important, yes, I felt like that. Or, most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. If I don't believe that this program can work for me, it won't. I have to believe it. What is our second step? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So I believe. I put dates in this book when I found them. I transmitted it from that book to this book because that's what I know. But on May the 11th of 1979. I read this and I said, yes, I believe that this program can work for me too.